From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It hasn't even been released yet, and still the controversial book Clinton Cash is making headlines. The book is full of bold charges about the Clinton Foundation, of political favors for donors, high speaking fees for Bill Clinton while Hillary was Secretary of State, a pattern the author says that should warrant further investigation. And some journalists have taken that up. This hour on Point, author Peter Schweitzer and Clinton Cash. You can join us on air or online. Have you heard the claims? What do you make of them? A problem for the candidate? A smear campaign? Join us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Listeners, we did reach out to the Clinton campaign, and after agreeing to join us, they canceled late yesterday afternoon. Joining me today from New York is Peter Schweitzer, author of the new and controversial book out next week, Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Government and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Schweitzer's previous book, Throw Them All Out, about stock trades and congressional insider trading, led Congress to pass the Stock Act, which prohibits lawmakers from insider trading. Peter Schweitzer, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me, Jane.
So there's a lot in this book, a lot of detail, a lot of investigative reporting, which we will unpack throughout this hour. But set the table for the conversation and give us the headline of this book.
Well, I think the headline of this book is that, you know, we all, I think, on all sides of the spectrum have expressed concern about money in politics, whether that's, you know, campaign contributions, PACs, lobbying, et cetera. What I try to point out in this book is that something has happened with this sort of unique situation we had with Bill and Hillary Clinton when she became Secretary of State. And that is that we had foreign entities. That's really the focus of the book. Foreign entities, businessmen, governments and corporations. That sought the Clinton Foundation and speaking fees as an avenue to curry favor and influence with the Clintons. And that I think this represents sort of a fundamental change because there are very few consensus points about money in politics in America, what the solutions are. But I do think everybody agrees that to have foreign interests trying to influence our politics and doing so is a real problem. So that's kind of the super big picture look at this.
So let's go overseas and talk about in the book, you mentioned the fact that Bill Clinton's speaking fees actually went up quite dramatically when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton, obviously a very eloquent spokesman, and as all ex-presidents do, and I think they're certainly entitled to when he left the White House, hit the lecture circuit. The problem is in 2009, something happened. You know, either he became much more eloquent, or I think it had more to do with the fact that Hillary was now Secretary of State. So large paydays from overseas entities, for example, speeches of $500,000 or more. Bill Clinton, his entire speaking career from 2001 up to the end of her tenure as Secretary of State, he had given 13 speeches that paid him $500,000 or more. 11 of those occurred while she was Secretary of State. And these were companies that that had business before the State Department. Was this coincidence? Was this an attempt to influence? I think there's enough examples, Jane, to where you have to ask the question and start to entertain the fact that these speaker payments were attempts to influence the Clintons and made them wealthy.
Well, there are many examples for sure. But as you know, the Clinton campaign says you haven't produced one piece of evidence that shows that Hillary Clinton acted in any way to support the interests of donors, foreign donors, while she was Secretary of State. I quote Bill Alston here of the Sunline Foundation, who says it's an independent government ethics organization. He said there's no smoking gun, no evidence that she changed policy based on donations to the Clinton Foundation or to Bill Clinton. Is there a smoking gun here? Did you find a smoking gun?
Well, I think that's a great question, Jane. I think the smoking gun is in the pattern of behavior. And here's the analogy that I would use. As you mentioned earlier, I did a book on insider trading on the stock market by members of Congress. And I talked to prosecutors who deal with those cases. And look, they said it's very rare that somebody that engages in insider trading sends an email to a friend and says, I've got inside information, buy this stock tomorrow. The way that you usually get prosecuted is by a pattern of behavior, a pattern of well-timed time stock trades. My contention is that there is a pattern of, you know, well-timed speaking fees and contributions to the Clinton Foundation that occur that we know the payer in these cases had business before the State Department. And I think the evidence is far more compelling than the evidence that was brought against, you know, former Virginia Governor McDonnell, who's convicted on these charges, and Senator Menendez of New Jersey. Both of those prosecutions, I think, were justified. I think the evidence here is more compelling. And in those cases, there was no quid pro quo demonstrated. And I don't think that's the bar that is necessary to prove here.
You liken the donations made to the Clinton Foundation during the time that Hillary Clinton served as Secretary of State. You liken that to insider trading. You mentioned your former book on that topic, but give us an example of that. How so?
Well, just a couple of examples. And again, I think, you know, Jane, you've read the book. I mean, I'm very careful to say I don't look into the head of Hillary Clinton and pretend to know why she makes a decision. But just a couple of examples. Bill Clinton, in late 2008, as Hillary Clinton is up for Secretary of State, is signed on by a financial entity called TD Bank Canada to give a series of 10 speeches for like $2 million. Now, TD Bank had never sponsored Bill Clinton to give a speech before. He gives those speeches. The last speech is given in the spring of 2011. 4 months after that, the State Department, under Hillary's direction, authorizes the environmental impact and the evaluation that the Keystone XL pipeline can go ahead. What's curious about that is that this TD Bank Investment Group was the largest shareholder in the Keystone XL pipeline at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, you could look at that and say, well, that's just coincidence, and you might be right. But the problem is there are numerous other examples like that. And I tend to believe when it comes to money flowing into politics, there are some coincidences. But when you see a bunch of coincidences, it's not a coincidence. It's a trend.
Maybe coincidence, maybe unseemly. Do you have any evidence that a crime may have been committed? I think that's what a lot of people are questioning. Maybe this is just coincidence. Was there anything worse?
I mean, I'm not an attorney. I don't have subpoena power. I don't have access to, you know, emails and the server, which I guess a lot of people don't have access to. But, you know, I'm a journalist. I don't pretend to be, you know, the prosecutor and the jury. But I think that the evidence is far more compelling than the evidence that prosecutors that led to an investigation of Governor McDonnell in Virginia or Senator Menendez. It's far more comprehensive. And that's really what I call for in the book, that individuals with subpoena power that have the capability to actually drill in and investigate this need to engage, because there's just too many examples for there to be a coincidence.
A lot of callers and listeners chiming in on this. Norman says, here we go again, the Republican witch hunt. Democrats say you are a partisan, Peter Schweitzer. You once worked for President George W. Bush as a speechwriter, that you work for a conservative news website, that you're funded by the Koch brothers. I mean, what's your response to your motivation behind this work?
Well, I am a conservative. There's no question about that. But that's different in my mind than being a Republican. I mean, in my last two books, I dinged plenty of Republicans, including Speaker of the House John Boehner. It should also be pointed out, by the way, that when the book was finished and I had the galleys of the book, I actually took the galleys to the investigative team at The New York Times, the investigative team at The Washington Post, the news side of Fox News, and the investigative unit at ABC News. And I told them, look, I think there's some very interesting, compelling things here. And they have done reporting that confirms what I found. So you can look at my motivation and sort of, you know, shoot the messenger to avoid dealing with the message. But there are plenty of, you know, very aggressive top line investigative reporters who are looking at this and finding the same troubling patterns.
We'll speak to a couple of those top line reporters in just a moment. But getting back to the book again, Peter Schweitzer, you say that in your reporting, quote, raises serious and alarming questions about judgment of possible indebtedness to an array of foreign investors and foreign interests, and ultimately of fitness for high public office. How does your reporting show that Hillary may be unfit for the presidency?
Well, I think the issue, of course, I'm raising the question there. The issue is always, when it comes to money in politics, if you've got, you know, huge amounts of money flowing into campaign coffers from certain entities, the question always has to be asked, what does the donor want? And what, if anything, has the donor been promised? And what is the expectation? And I think that those very same questions need to be asked here because, number one, the amounts of money are staggering. You know, we look at PAC contributions where, you know, a company or individuals donates, you know, $10,000, $20,000 to a PAC. We're talking about, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars that are being donated by entities that are tied to a particular company. The second thing is, this is money that, in terms of speaking fees, is ending up in their pocket. So to me, it is an extremely legitimate question, and it leads one to wonder why even the appearance of this, why the need to continue to grab as much money as possible from some very, very nefarious and shaky individuals, whether they operate in Africa or other countries, to be taking this kind of money at a time when she is the Secretary of State. I mean, it's just, in my mind, this is my, you know, subjective opinion, it's just very, very bad judgment. Very bad judgment.
It's been reported that you're working on a book now about Jeb Bush's business dealings. What have you found there? Do you see a similar pattern?
Well, that actually, Bloomberg was the first to report that and got it correct. We're doing a report. We're looking at his tenure as governor of Florida. So it's not technically a book. It's kind of morphed into that with additional reporting, but it's a report. We are partnering or sharing that information with news outlets as we've done with this previous project. But yes, we found, similar questions that you can look at, things related to an airport deal, land deals in Florida, corporate boards that Jeb Bush joined. We're about 4 months into that research project. We already have media outlets we're sharing that information with. And I would say by early fall, that will be coming out.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the new allegations surrounding the Clinton Foundation, brought up in the hot new book, Clinton Cash. Author Peter Schweitzer is with us. Here's some sound from the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday night. President Obama making a joke about Hillary Clinton and saying that as she begins her presidential campaign, she's going from riches to rags.
For many Americans, this is still a time of deep uncertainty. For example, I have one friend. Just a few weeks ago, she was making millions of dollars a year, and she's now living out of a van in Iowa.
At that same dinner on Saturday, comedian Cecily Strong segued from talking about Tom Cotton, the author of the highly controversial GOP letter to Iranian leaders, to a joke about the Clinton Foundation.
Now, in Tom Cotton's defense, he was just trying to repair America's strained relationship with Israel. But you know what? He doesn't need to worry about that. Our relationship will be better in the next administration, just as soon as Israel makes a generous donation to the Clinton Foundation.
Listeners, again, we did reach out to the Clinton campaign, and after first agreeing to join us, they backed out late yesterday afternoon. Peter Schweitzer is with us, and I want to bring in two other guests now. From Washington, Rosalind Helderman, political enterprise and investigative reporter for The Washington Post. The Washington Post got an early copy of Peter's book and has done their own investigative, independent reporting. Rosalind Helderman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Also from Washington, Joshua Green, national political reporter for Bloomberg News. He also read an advanced copy of the book, has done some reporting on this as well. Josh Green, welcome to you.
Good to be with you guys.
So, Rosalind Helderman, I'll start with you. This was a unique model of investigative journalism. As Peter mentioned, he shared his findings with journalists at The New York Times, The Washington Post, Fox News, ABC News, and they did their own reporting on his work, and even beyond it, you did reporting at the Washington Post. What stood out to you from Peter's investigation of Bill and Hillary Clinton?
You know, Peter really took kind of a broad view and looked all over the world. He delved into some examples in some countries far away with public documents that are not available in the United States that I think had not yet received close attention. I would sort of quibble with your description of the agreement that we had as unique. I actually think it's a fairly common arrangement for book publishers to provide early copies of books that are coming out to news organizations so they can get a sense of what's going to be in them and see whether or not they're going to be newsworthy. And I think in this case, Peter's book clearly is.
Fair enough. So what did you find and what was interesting to you about it?
So I was interested in the section on the speeches. We were, in fact, working on our own story, which just ran recently, that kind of dovetails with Peter's finding about Bill Clinton's paid speaking career. In our reporting, we found, for instance, that Bill Clinton made $26 million over 10 years from paid speaking engagements in front of organizations who had also given money to the Clinton Foundation. It really shows the way in which President Clinton's speaking career had become very much intertwined with this foundation. In many of these speeches, he would go and he would talk about the foundation. He would talk about its great work, and the organizations would make clear that that was part of why he was being invited, was to speak about the work of his charity. But then at the same time, he would make $400,000, $500,000 to give those speeches about his charitable work.
All right, intertwined, but to what end? Did it end there? Did it end with the speech? Did you find anything nefarious afterward?
So I think that's the piece of Peter's book that there's still a lot of work going on about. I have not seen the reporting to sort of pull out the smoking gun that directly connects one of these speeches or donations directly 100% to a benefit provided by the State Department. I think one thing that is extraordinarily clear, though, is that they were taking millions of dollars in charitable donations to the foundation and then also in paid speaking fees from organizations, from companies, in some cases from foreign governments that certainly had interest in front of the U.S. government. It does appear as though people were attempting to curry favor with them through these avenues, and there's still work going on. Obviously, the Clinton Foundation has outright rejected it, but still work going on about whether or not, in fact, they succeeded.
Josh Green, Peter Schweitzer, and the New York Times did significant reporting on one story about the State Department decision to approve the sale of uranium mines to a Russian company that donated a lot of money, over $2 million to the Clinton Global Initiative, and that a Russian investment bank promoted the deal in paying Bill Clinton $500,000 for a speech in Moscow. Can you talk about the significance of this story and what you found as you reported on it?
Well, what you find in Peter's book, he actually has an elegant term for it. He calls it the Clinton blur. And what he means by that is sort of the commingling of Bill Clinton's personal speaking fees, which often range into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, along with State Department policy, and then oftentimes charity, either from foreign governments or from big billionaire donors like the uranium magnate at the heart of this story. And what the book lays out is sort of chapter after chapter after chapter of these different characters, all of whom seem to be engaged in this kind of Clinton blur. And so in this case, I better let Peter speak to the details of this. I believe you're referring to a guy named Frank Giustra.
Correct.
Who is a billionaire Canadian uranium magnate, who I actually just spoke to, is a board member of the Clinton Foundation. He actually helped found the Canadian arm of the Clinton Foundation and has given tens of millions of dollars to Bill Clinton over the years, lent him his private jet, actually flew with Clinton, I believe, over to Kazakhstan to close one of these uranium deals. And so he's the perfect example of the kind of relationship that Peter illuminates in this book, which is the commingling of billionaires and their private business with government policy, with Bill Clinton's reputation. And what happens in all of these cases is that a lot of money winds up flowing into the Clinton Foundation, and usually a lot of business deals get done by these different characters who have kind of attached themselves to Clinton and become, I think of them almost as satellites that orbit around the Clinton Foundation.
Peter Schweitzer.
Yes, I think that when you look at these kinds of complex deals, like the uranium deal, for example, you're talking about a series of contributions and a number of investors. The Uranium One case, for example, there's actually nine individuals who gave to the Clinton Foundation who were either shareholders in Uranium One, were the financiers that arranged the financing for the Russian takeover, or were shareholders in the deal, or in one case, the intel for the chairman of it. So it's something that I think is difficult to explain. I'm not, they sort of say that I'm claiming these are conspiracies. policies. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy. I think you have a market of influence in politics, and that market expresses itself in different ways, sometimes as campaign contributions. This is a different market that I don't think people have realized, where you're trying to buy access and influence with the Clintons, a decision maker in this case, Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and you can do so in a way that previously was unimaginable.
But Peter Schweitzer, there's no evidence at all that Hillary Clinton got directly involved in any decision related to this particular case at the State Department when she was Secretary of State. I mean, do you have any evidence that she intervened?
Well, the point that I make in the book is that we don't know. We do know that there were a series of government agencies, as I mentioned in the book, that needed to sign off on this. If the State Department had not signed off, it would have kicked in this special investigation. But no other government agencies had individuals that had received $145 million in contributions. So the question that I simply ask is, we need to look at those records. We need to review the CFIUS records, because we're asking essentially to take the word of the Clintons when we know that there have already been issues with the lack of full disclosure of contributions. Both the journalists on the air here have reported on that and broke that story, where you have 1,100 contributors. So I'm skeptical if I'm told by the Clintons that she was not involved, because the track record of disclosure on these issues is not particularly good.
I got to get a caller in here, David from Williamstown, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Glad you called. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to say first that I've read Peter Schweitzer's book, Extortion, and I came away from it thinking that he gave a pretty even-handed rendering of how, in essence, stagnation in our government benefits not only lobbyists, but maybe as much or more so the people who are in power and who, you know, play that game to get money out of dragging things out. But to the point here, with regard to circumstantial evidence, I have a friend, you'll just have to take my word on this, who is an appeals court judge. I won't say what state or at what level, at state or federal, I'll leave it there. And a couple of years ago, I got together with him for coffee, and I showed him an old newspaper article in which a man was convicted and got capital punishment based almost entirely on circumstantial evidence. And it was outright almost laughable, the whole case. And he read it, quickly looked over it, and then he looked at me and said, you know, Dave, sometimes the circumstantial evidence is more compelling than actual evidence. And so I just leave you with that and take your reactions off air.
David, thank you very much. There's so many examples in this book, Peter Schweitzer. I want to get to another one here in Haiti. A chapter of your book is about the Haiti development efforts after the 2010 earthquake. And you say that the Clintons had a lot of power when it came to using U.S. taxpayer money for Haitian relief. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, we had this horrific earthquake that occurred in January of 2010. And in response to that, obviously, a lot of generosity by the American people. The U.S. government committed to putting in, $3 billion. Hillary Clinton, of course, was Secretary of State. Cheryl Mills, her chief of staff, was point person at the State Department. And Bill Clinton was brought in as the co-head of the IHRC, the International Relief Commission that was supposed to help dole out the money. And again, this is part of this Clinton blur, because there are contracts and there are development decisions that are being made, and those development decisions benefit people who have been generous to the Clinton Foundation.
So you're saying Clinton Foundation foreign investors got many of the contracts, benefited from some of the development projects? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. And, somebody would say, well, you know, do you have an email or evidence, direct evidence of coordination? No, I don't. I mean, I don't have subpoena power. I'm an author. I'm a journalist. But again, it sort of fits the pattern again. And this is what happens when you get these sort of relationships where, you know, Bill Clinton goes to Haiti and he's literally wearing three hats. He's the co-head of the IHRC. He's an ex-president. He's got his own foundation. He's got business, associates and friends. And so when he arrives in Haiti and is making these decisions, you know, what is the motivation behind that decision? It's very troubling because of this interchange of money.
Rosalind Helderman, political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post. You reported earlier this week that Bill Clinton is heading to Africa on a foundation trip with 20 major Clinton Foundation donors, many of whom have also supported Hillary Clinton's political campaigns. Speak about that and what strikes you about this particular relationship.
Sure. I mean, I think you can kind of see encapsulated in that particular incident the way in which this foundation has become completely entwined with their political and personal lives. You know, the foundation says this is something that has happened routinely. He pretty much annually takes a big international trip, and he takes a delegation of major foundation donors with him, they say, so that these people can see their money in action. But you look at the list of folks who are going on this trip, and it's people who have hosted fundraisers for Hillary Clinton at their houses. It's people who have given money to the Ready for Hillary PAC. And it starts to appear as though, you know, if you make a major donation to the foundation, you can get several days worth of access to the former U.S. president who's married to a presidential candidate, which is a very valuable thing in Washington.
Peter Schweitzer, you and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal confirmed, they confirmed your reporting on a multi-million dollar donation to the Clinton Foundation that was never disclosed by the Clintons, many donations actually, which was in breach of an agreement they signed with the White House. This is also in your book. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, the Obama transition team in 2008, when Hillary was put forward as Secretary of State, created this memorandum of understanding, which required disclosure. And if you look how it defines it, it's pretty much wide open. It's complete disclosure of all donations. We found in the book and reported in the book on a $2.35 million donation from the chairman of this uranium company that becomes Russian-owned that was never disclosed. As a result of that, and we mentioned some others in the book as well, as a result of that, we now have this story that's been unfolding, and actually the two journalists you have on you know, really broke this story. We have this situation where now the Clinton Foundation is admitting that you have 1,100 undisclosed donations that have flowed through this Canadian entity. So you have this circumstance where they clearly have not been transparent as they promised. I would also add that there is a gentleman listed as a donor for between $1 and $5 million named Amar Singh, a former member of parliament in India, who I point out in the book does not have the money to donate between $1 and $5 million. He came out with a statement yesterday saying, no, that wasn't my money. So even when you have disclosed names, you have questions now being raised about whether those were actually the people that put the money in the Clinton Foundation. So very troubling as far as transparency is concerned.
Josh Green, how do you add to this particular story Peter just laid out?
Well, I think we did. I mean, if you read Peter's book, he was the first guy to sort of sniff out that there was this Canadian arm of the Clinton Foundation that hadn't actually been disclosing its donors. And he had a couple names in the book. And as Roslyn reported in the Post, and as I reported in Bloomberg with one of my colleagues, I wound up speaking to the guy, the billionaire himself, who said, look, it's not just three or four names. There's actually 1,100 of them, foreign donors, who we can't reveal their names, even though we've agreed to do it because there's a federal privacy law in Canada that forbids us from doing this. So I think this is actually a good illustration of how the book is pointing things out, relationships, places to look, that mainstream journalists are taking kind of the baton and advancing the story. And literally just as we've been on the air, a colleague forwarded me a new article from the Boston Globe saying the Boston wing of the Clinton Foundation has also failed to report a number of foreign donors because, as the spokesman tells the Globe, they deemed it unnecessary. So I think the real sort of value of the book is that it has sort of shined a light on this, and it's become clear that there are all sorts of things that were agreed to or that were supposed to happen on the Clinton Foundation side of things that haven't for any host of reasons. And so there are an awful lot of people out there who are influencing the Clintons, whose names we don't know, whose donations we don't know. That certainly seems relevant as we think about should Hillary Clinton become the next president.
Listeners, again, we did reach out to the Clinton campaign, and after first agreeing to join us, they backed out late yesterday afternoon. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the new book, Clinton Cash, and its controversial claims. I do want to remind everyone that the Clinton campaign agreed to join us for this hour and then backed out late yesterday afternoon. We're speaking with Joshua Green, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, Rosalind Helderman, political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post, and Peter Schweitzer, author of the new book, Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Government and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich. Let's get Kim in here from Boston. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I'd like to have your guest comment about, first of all, this just seems like a very one-sided discussion here, and I understand you reached out to the Clinton Foundation. But I'm wondering if you could comment about something that I find was extremely egregious, which is we started a war in Iraq, and then we destroyed a country and then sent in Halliburton, which is clearly an arm of Mr. Cheney, who was our vice president, who made a fortune out of repairing that country with the contracts that they received. And to me, this seems far more egregious than donations made to an organization that's doing good around the world. And I will take my comment response off the air.
Kim, thank you very much.
I'd be happy to respond. I've actually written about Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq War. And the problems that caused her in the last campaign. And so I think maybe the way to address that in a Clinton context is to point out that she's actually apologized for that vote in her new book. I guess it's not so new anymore, but in her most recent book, she kind of came out and said, you know, it was a mistake. I'm sorry I did that. And has cleaned that up, I think, because her Iraq war vote last time around was probably the mistake that not only helped launch that Bush war, which your caller claims was so wonderful for Halliburton, but also allowed the rise of Barack Obama, who obviously beat her last time around. So she has addressed that, I think, so that it doesn't become an issue in this campaign.
That's Josh Green, national political reporter for Bloomberg. Peter Schweitzer, respond to Kim's point. There are egregious examples of many things concerning money and politics on both sides here.
Well, I do think, yes, that it's always legitimate to look at economic motivations behind decision making. I'm the first to say that that's not the only thing that factors in, but I think it's an important factor. There's a whole school of economics called public choice theory that says we need to look at our political leaders and see them as economic actors. I would say that this, I think, is a little bit unique in that in my book and I think with a lot of the reporting that's come out is we're not talking about sort of unfortunately, run-of-the-mill influencing by U.S. corporations. We are actually here talking about foreigners, and that is foreign businessmen, foreign companies, and foreign governors. And if there is one consensus point that we seem to still have on the money and politics issue on the left and right is that we don't want foreign entities influencing our political system. So I would say that certainly makes this case unique and different than it does in a lot of the other stories you hear about money and politics.
Peter Schweitzer, I know you have to run. Thank you very much for your time today. Peter is the founder and director of the Government Accountability Institute. He's the author of the new book, Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Government and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich. Peter, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane.
And Rosalind Helderman, I know you have to run as well, political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post. I appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Josh, stick with us here. I'm going to bring another voice into the conversation from New York, Joe Connison. He is editor-in-chief of the National Memo. He's author of The Hunting of the President, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. He's read an e-copy of Clinton Cash. Joe Connison, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
So you're not here as a Clinton defender per se, but what do you make of Peter Schweitzer's book, his claims about Bill and Hillary Clinton?
Well, you know, a lot of the claims are being knocked down. I mean, he made mistakes concerning his chapter on India, in which he makes claims about votes that Hillary Clinton cast that were the opposite of what she did. His theory about the Uranium One sale to Rosatom, the Russian group, which I assume you've talked about already, perhaps on the show, maybe not, but it's kind of a central claim and was followed up by the New York Times. You know, if you read his book, he makes it sound as if Hillary Clinton was the one who's going to decide the fate of this sale, and that it was very controversial, and so on. But the truth is, the committee he doesn't even accurately describe the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which actually decides that, which is a committee based in the Treasury Department, chaired by the Treasury Department, and which has nine other agencies on it. Any one of them could have told the president that you should look at this deal, you should possibly disapprove this deal. The State Department had no way to stop the deal by itself, and none of those agencies decided to do that.
Let me quote
unanimously approved by
yeah
by, this
of, by all nine. I understand.
Treasury.
Let me quote the Washington Post, Karen Tumulty, because I think this is the point, sort of the heart of it. She writes that this massive fundraising and wealth generation operation that the Clintons have built over the last decade, quote, has revived one of the most enduring criticisms of them, that, quote, they have a blind spot when it comes to setting ethical boundaries with the people who give them money. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I mean, I don't. Well, they may have, but this book certainly doesn't demonstrate it in any way. You know, the deals that he talks about, he either gets wrong the details of how Mrs. Clinton responded in the State Department, or he exaggerates her role, as in the Russian uranium case. I mean, I think it matters a lot that she could not have controlled that the outcome of that deal, had no way to do that, because it undermines the entire theory of his book. Why would anyone at Uranium One be paying off anybody in the Clinton world if they couldn't control the outcome of the deal?
Josh Green, national reporter for Bloomberg. What do you make of this? I mean, bad facts here? That's what Joe Connison is alleging.
I haven't fact-checked the book myself. The stuff that I've done reporting on has panned out. I mean, there's often questions of interpretation. I think Peter Schweitzer, as we've said, is a conservative and tends to see bad behavior on the part of the Clintons in a lot of these examples, whereas I think people like Joe, who is an inveterate Clinton defender, would be much less likely to see corruption and
that
sort of thing.
True.
No, hey, let me, Joe, if you don't mind, let me make
true,
my
Josh.
Point before you
said something about me that's false.
Hold on, Josh,
well,
continue, and then Joe, you can respond.
I love
much more Barack Obama in 2008. Okay,
go ahead, Josh.
You ready, Joe? So the point I was going to make really was, I think Joe hasn't said it. I'll say the Clinton campaign has said there is no smoking gun here that shows Hillary Clinton doing something illegal. And I think it's important to stipulate that that is absolutely true. That's the case. But there are dozens of examples of characters like these Russians popping up in the book. And I think it's hard for any objective reader to come away not thinking that the Clintons have, at the very least, shown extremely poor judgment in who they've chosen to associate with and take money from. But I think it's an open question as to whether this is really going to prove politically damaging, or whether, as Karen Tumulty, the Post reporter you just quoted, said, this is just sort of the Clintons' style of operating. They're brilliant politicians, they do a lot of good, but they also tend to be sloppy in ways that causes ethical concerns and political problems for them. And I think what I'll be looking for when this book comes out is, as reporters read it, dig into it, and report out some of these stories, will it turn out to be just sloppy accounting or failure to disclose, or will there be something more serious there that could pose a real problem to Clinton's designs in the White House?
Joe Connison, does this come down to optics, the appearance of a conflict of interest? There may be no quid pro quo, no smoking gun, but it really is just the perception of a conflict.
Well, as I said, Jane, first of all, in some of the cases in the book, I don't know what Josh has reported, frankly, but in some of the instances, the facts are the opposite of what would constitute a conflict of interest. So, for instance, the whole narrative about Frank Giustra, who was once the principal of Uranium One, kind of falls apart when you know that he sold his interest in that company in 2007, 2 years before Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State. He is a big donor to the Clinton Foundation, it's true. But the theory that he was doing that in order to make a uranium deal go through makes no sense if you know he didn't own the company when the deal went through anymore. You understand?
I agree with Joe on that point, by the way.
So that's kind of yes, but you see, in case after case, I mean, you know, Josh, I'm sorry I interrupted you. I don't appreciate that characterization. You know, I criticized Hillary Clinton much more in 2008 than I did Barack Obama on issues, on the conduct of her campaign. So the idea that I defend them in every circumstance is absolutely false.
I got to jump in here, fellas. Let me get Vicki in here from Butler, Tennessee. Vicki, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wish Hillary Clinton would get out of the race. First of all, she's so polarizing that I don't think she can win the presidency. So she should get out of the way and let someone else have the nomination. And this is just one more example of the swirl of controversy that always has to surround the Clintons. So if she were to win the presidency, she couldn't be effective because the focus would be on this kind of thing during her whole term of office. So I virtually always vote Democratic, but I can't tell you how much I wish she would just get the heck out of the race.
Vicki, thank you. Here's Ellen in Somerville, South Carolina. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a quick comment on the book, which I haven't read, but I didn't hear anybody talk about what Mr. Clinton does with the funds that he makes for speeches. What are his taxes? How much of those funds are going to his own initiative? And I also would like to know if there was anything in the book that interviews the people that actually made the donations to find out what their motivation actually was.
Ellen, thank you. Josh Green, take over here for a minute. First, Ellen's question is about tax returns following the money and personal use by the Clintons.
Well, I mean, Bill Clinton, I think a few newspapers have reported has earned something like $106 million in speaking fees since he left the White House. But he's a private citizen. He's certainly entitled to earn that money. There's obviously a great demand for his services. I'm not aware of any accusations that he's done anything untoward or hasn't paid his taxes. I could be wrong about this, and Joe, correct me if I am. I believe since he's not a public official, he doesn't need or no obligation to disclose his tax returns. But I'm not aware of any scandal there, and if you read the Schweitzer book, I don't believe he alleges one. It's not so much the money Clinton has earned personally, but the commingling of Clinton's personal earnings with charity and government policy. But I don't think Bill Clinton's personal earnings are really an issue here.
Joe Connison?
He tries to link the speeches to various decisions that Hillary did or didn't make, and that does come up in the book. But
he's not alleging, you know, suitcases of cash are being handed to Bill Clinton or that he's
earning
money in a way he shouldn't be earning it.
Yeah, over 30 years, the Clintons have disclosed more about their taxes than I think any couple in American history. If you go back and you look, they've disclosed more tax returns. And if you see, they pay a substantial rate of taxes. And there's just no question about that. She had to disclose almost all of his speeches when she was in the Senate, which was almost 8 years. So that's all has been on the public record for a long time. What's interesting to me is very little attention is paid to what the foundation actually does in this book or elsewhere. I've traveled with Clinton to see what the foundation does, as have some other reporters, and they do real things for real people around the world.
And there's no question they do tremendous good. Yeah, but let me ask you about the New York Times editorial page that essentially calls for the full and complete disclosure of all sources of money going to the Clinton Foundation, and that the foundation needs to reinstate the ban on donations from foreign governments and the rest of her campaign. Do you agree that that would be a good idea?
Well, it depends what you mean by donations from foreign governments, Jane. If they banned all money from foreign governments that went through the Clinton Foundation or its partners, money from governments like Norway, Ireland, the United Kingdom, governments that have long been spotless allies of the United States, thousands upon thousands of people would likely be deprived of AIDS medication, for example, because that they have come to depend on the Clinton Foundation to make sure that money is spent on the medications that keep them alive. So the Times may airily, recommend something like that, but I frankly don't think that's a brilliant idea.
So Josh Green,
I don't see how anyone could be opposed to at least exposing where the donations come from. I mean, sunlight is always
a good with that at all.
You don't have to necessarily ban the donations, but I do think it would be a good idea, not only for reporters and ordinary people, but frankly for the Clintons themselves. If they were to publicly disclose all the sources of their money and kind of do it once and for all, so you don't have these stories day after day after day after day of undisclosed foreign donors.
As far as I can tell, about 99% of them have been disclosed. If you go and look on the website, which I'm sure you have done, there are thousands upon thousands of donations disclosed in all categories of amount. And by far, the greatest number of donations have been disclosed. A few donations from Canada apparently were not disclosed because...
Well, I found 1,100 from Canada from foreign donors that weren't disclosed. I mean, it seems wild to identify who those donors were.
I've got about a minute left here, Josh Green. I want to get your sort of political perspective. You're a national political reporter for Bloomberg. How do you see this playing out for Hillary Clinton in 2016?
Well, you know, usually these things are difficult. The press swarms this sort of thing. There was, at the very least, I think, sloppiness or miscommunication within the Clinton Foundation, which promised the White House they would disclose all donors and hasn't. And so part of it, I think, depends on how many more of these donations there are. But the fact is there's always this kind of, you know, minor scandal burbling and reporters getting upset at the Clintons. That's sort of the backdrops to their political lives. And it didn't stop Bill Clinton from getting to the White House. I suspect it probably won't stop Hillary Clinton either.
Joshua Green, national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you.
Joe Connison, editor-in-chief of the National Memo. Thank you as well, Joe. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.